Oh, yeah. Well, these are, I have the notes from last week were chapter 25, and then these are the first part of the notes for chapter 26, so you can, somebody can help us out. There's about 10 of them, I guess. So, again, last week, if you got the notes, those are the ones for this chapter on marriage. So chapter 25 is on marriage. It's got four paragraphs. Going to define what marriage is. We're going to give the purpose of marriage, the legality of marriage, and the degrees of marriage. So a couple of chapters ago, we looked at worship, and that dealt with the church. Then last week, we looked at government and our role with respect to that, and that deals with the state. So this deals with the third of the three great institutions God has created, which is the family, specifically focusing on marriage. Now, we could spend a lot of time if we were in some other churches on this chapter. Hopefully we don't need to with this group. But I wrote here that this is a topic that our forefathers, when they wrote this, could not have dreamed in their worst nightmares what would become of this topic of marriage. And yet, I find it fascinating that they still, in their context, as Christian a context as you're ever going to get on this planet for a culture, they still believe that it was such an important doctrine that they needed to put an entire chapter to it in the Confession of Faith. Put this into perspective. You go on to a typical evangelical website and you look up what they believe, and you're lucky if you find six sentences of the totality of what they believe. We have four paragraphs just on marriage. Okay, so this is a different world that we're living in today. So let's kind of go through this then. First is the definition of marriage. Marriage is to be between one man and one woman. Neither is it lawful for any man to have more than one wife, nor for any woman to have more than one husband at the same time. Now, it's funny because in my notes that I had in 2006, the professor only gave the last two as examples, which are that polygamy is forbidden and polyandry is forbidden, which is the having many husbands. So many wives, many husbands. And those are stated explicitly. But in the last 15 years, we have had to be very explicit, so explicit that some churches have had to write entire documents that they put into their constitution to say, to kind of cover themselves with the law that we do not believe that homosexuality is allowed in marriage. I think it's interesting that we really, if you want to be technical about it, we don't need to have any more written about that in order to say that our church does not believe that homosexuality is tolerable. We've already got it here. And that's the first sentence, isn't it? Marriage is to be between one man and one woman. So automatically that gets rid of any form of homosexual unions. And then I put here just not really for fun, but it gets rid of even more deviant forms. And there's all kinds of them out there. I remember watching at daytime one of those horrible talk shows that are just, they're nothing but sewage that goes into your living room. And they had all these girls on that were like marrying the Eiffel Tower and the Empire State Building and the ocean. It's incredible.
Yeah, I got a question.
Yeah.
I'm linking it back to Solomon when you read about his life. So he asked for wisdom.
Yeah.
He had some kind of wisdom, but immediately he did wrong things maritally. He married an Egyptian that was an unbeliever.
Mm-hmm.
Rehoboam's mother was a Hittite. That was the next king, had an unrighteous mother. So his wisdom seemed to be isolated into maybe worldly wisdom when he started out asking for it, because he instantly started beating off into things that were just going to hurt him.
Well, this is the paradox that I was talking about in the sermon, that we kind of want to say it's worldly wisdom, but this is what's so weird about the book, is that, and I think Solomon wrote Ecclesiastes, so it's, I assume that. When he goes, he says what, like verse 24 or whatever, where he says, you know, basically, I went to do everything evil that I could. I wanted to be as evil as I could so that I could tell you what you shouldn't do all the time using wisdom. And we're like, well, how can you possibly do that? How can you use wisdom and go be evil? That doesn't make any sense. That's the paradox of the thing. And his whole conclusion is, I can't tell you how God runs this world. I can't tell you how to go get wisdom. I can just tell you that he's the God who gives it to you and he's sovereign and you should fear him and do what he says. That's his ultimate conclusion. But he lives his whole life in contradiction to this. And if in your mind, when you read like a section like we saw today, especially when he comes to the two women passages, but even before that, if you're not thinking Solomon and his 300 wives and 700 concubines, if that's not coming into your mind, then you need to go read the story of Solomon again.
Yeah, because when he says, I found one upright man among those 1,000, not one upright woman among them all, that was probably all his wives.
I know, right? And it's interesting because there's 1,000 of them, right? So, yep.
I have been thinking about David on this topic.
Sure.
God called him the apple of his eye. I mean, he was somebody special to God. Yeah, he had
Well, and yeah, that's right. He had several wives himself. Solomon learned it from his daddy, the man after God's own heart. And so the church, you know, has gone to great pains over 2,000 years to keep this from taking place in our midst. You can go all the way back to Paul, really, and his requirements for elders. You're only supposed to have, you know, one wife. Because they knew the dangers of this. I mean, all you have to do is look at the beginning of Israel itself with Jacob marrying two women to see what that created. So wisdom, and certainly it's the way that God created us originally, one man and one woman in the Garden of Eden. So that's the definition of marriage. It should be self-explanatory. It is to us. If we were in another context, we might have to defend ourselves and talk about it a lot more, but we're not, so I don't think we need to, unless you want to. So let's go to paragraph 2. Purpose of marriage. Marriage was ordained for the mutual help of husband and wife, comma, for the increase of mankind with a legitimate issue, comma, and the preventing of uncleanness. So it gives you three things that marriage is for. Marriage is given to help the husband and the wife. And so it's for their mutual help and benefit. They need each other. God, it's not good that God made man alone. So he gave him a helper. And when Adam says, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, this is Adam's marriage oath. He's taking an oath. He's marrying her so that she can help him. We see how quickly that goes astray, but that's what it was designed for. And in a Christian marriage, and I would say even to some degree in a tainted way in a non-Christian marriage, you still see reflections of how the image of God is working rightly. It's possible, and it's good when it happens. God does not make men and women exactly equal for every purpose. He gives us our sexuality. He gives us our physiques. He gives us our different temperaments. He gives us our different emotional outlooks on life so that when we come together, we can balance one another out. I believe that everything in our culture for the last 100 years has been about destroying this. There's a good reason to think that World War II and what came out of that with the 50s and the boom that happened, that the baby boomers and the American dream that became this iconic image in all of our minds with Happy Days and stuff like that. What did that do? It took the woman out of the home and it put her in the workplace. And the banksters knew also what they were doing, because they really in some ways forced that upon us. Because you couldn't make enough money to even pay your mortgage with just one income. So, you know, if we were looking at this 100 years ago, they were people that were the product of the confessions of faith working their way through a culture and having a real impact on the culture itself. We're on the other side of this for now 70 years or more, and we don't even understand the idea that men and women are to help one another in marriage. That's sexist. How dare you say that? But it's as biblical an idea as you can possibly get. Now, second thing it says is marriage is for procreation and the multiplication of our species. The increase of mankind, you see? So this is the biblical way that we go about procreating. It's in the context of marriage. We confess that. It's not in the context of adultery. It's not in the context of living with each other. It's in the context of marriage. And then third, marriage is for the preventing of uncleanness. So this is really specifically talking about your inability to control your sexual desire, and which Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 7. And so therefore, we can conclude from this that the confession sees marriage is for sexual pleasure. Something that the Puritans talked a lot about. They were not prudes that you hear about in public school that hated sex. They loved it and talked about it all the time. And wrote commentary. They're the only people that ever wrote commentaries on the Song of Solomon. Which, that's pretty much what that book's about. So, we affirm the goodness of sex, but we do it in the right context. You see? And we don't shy away from talking about it. Because God made it good. who said this to you?
All people. I finally just got to where I tell them, yeah, God created it and we enjoy it.
Right.
Did you tell me how I did that once?
All right, if anybody wants to stop, you can. Otherwise, we'll just keep going. Move to the legality of marriage. It is lawful for all sorts of people to marry who are able with judgment to give their consent, yet it is the duty of Christians to marry in the Lord, and therefore such as profess the true religion should not marry with infidels or idolaters, neither should such as are godly be unequally yoked by marrying with such as are wicked in their life or maintain damnable heresy. So there's an A and a B to this. First of all, the confession, paragraph 3 here, says that marriage is an institution that God gave to humanity, not just to Christians. Some people think marriage is only for Christians. No, it's an institution of civilization. Has been since the very, very, very beginning. This is why the pagans called adultery the great sin. How can you call adultery the great sin if you don't have marriage in your Babylonian world? Of course you do. This is what goes back to the beginning. So we affirm that it's lawful for all kinds of people to marry. This would also include normal people, not just for the elites, not just for royalty, not just for those who are physically whole. If you're paralyzed and you want to get married, you get married. Okay? But you have to be able to give your consent. So isn't that interesting? This confession would not allow for an 8-year-old girl to marry Muhammad. That's not marriage. That's pedophilia.
Hmm?
Now, it's interesting that even though it gives a blanket statement about marriages for all kinds of people, it restricts marriage for Christians. It does not restrict it for non-Christians. We can talk about what they would have said about that. I believe very strongly that they would have said, for example, based on what we saw in paragraph one, that no, you can't marry someone if you're two dudes, because we've already defined what marriage is. So I don't think that they would have, you could have used the confession as a way to say, well, non-Christians can get married if they're gay. And I don't think so. I don't think so, because we believe what marriage is, first of all, comes from God. But on general principles of what it's going to talk about now in terms of loving God, those kind of stuff, spiritual realities, it's not restricting unbelievers. If two unbelievers want to get married, they can get married. Okay?
I have a question.
Go for it.
There are basically two views throughout history that have been employed. The American, dating business, then you have the engagement, or what they call it, betrothal, or arranged marriages. Now, what did the Puritans say about that? Weren't they mainly for arranged?
I suppose the Puritans is a pretty big topic. I don't know that there would be one Puritan view on it. They don't speak about it here, which is interesting. I don't think they were out dating like we do today. That's a pretty new phenomenon.
I don't understand the worst possible way.
Arranged marriage would actually is kind of a, but it's very similar to betrothal, because you're betrothed to someone for a period of time, and usually that would be because the marriage was arranged for you.
But biblically speaking, there is no preference for anything.
No, I don't think you can find that the Bible forbids two young people from dating one another.
Or suggests.
I do think that you can make a case that they may not have known about dating, because pretty much everybody was being betrothed in those days. And that, I mean, that's just the way the practice was for almost all of history. But that's different from saying that it would forbid dating to marriage.
Does Al Martin, I'm sure you know who he is.
Yep.
I listened to a sermon by him talking about American Christians and how they are not married Christian yet. And so he gave a message about how they need not be so ignorant. They don't, guys don't have to look like that. But, yeah, he suggested that they be more aggressive by themselves.
Yeah, that's a great, great point. Like, anybody who's ever watched Seinfeld knows that there's a running thing in Seinfeld about how he can never find the perfect girl. And one of my favorite scenes in all of Seinfeld is when he's dating this beautiful blonde woman. And they're eating lobster. And she's got these, they get this dude like who's like 6'5 or something, hairy hands, and cracks open the lobster. And then he looks at her and he's like, oh, he's mortified at her hands because she has man hands. So she couldn't date him after. He couldn't date her after that. That's the point you're making. Stop being so picky, man. Live with the man hands, unless they really are a man's hands. Man hands would be, if it's literally a man's hands. So, well, this is what this talks about here. So what are the restrictions for Christians? First of all, they must marry in the Lord. This is not optional, by the way. So for those of you who are not married and looking to get married, this is what you need to be looking for. You must marry in the Lord. One needs to be a Christian. If one's a Christian, they both must be Christians. It's not one's a Christian and one isn't a Christian, and I'll make them a Christian later. Now, that's different than saying somebody's a dispensationalist and somebody's amillennialist. It doesn't say that. Okay? You can get as picky as you want to and find in your theology. You have to be a Christian. So you have to be. So what does that mean? Well, they must profess the true religion. They must not be infidels or an unbeliever. They must not be idolaters, so enter Solomon. They must be godly. So it's not enough to just profess, but you need to actually show signs that you're a Christian in your life. And they must not be wicked, which is the opposite of godly, and have damnable heresies. So damnable heresy would, again, not be a second or third order sort of a thing, disagreement. It would be the basics of the creed, you know. I'm not sure I'm following your question.
To not be unequally yoked, like in 1 Corinthians, it tells you that. That's
yeah.
That means that's why you have to marry a believer. But here it seems like it's separating an infidel like being unbeliever versus, like, is this mainly...
Yeah, I know your problem, because I have the same problem when I read it.
Okay.
I think that it's just... using a word that you could have used back at the very first part of this restriction at the end as a way of tying it in. Yeah, because it's not that unequally yoked means only wicked and damnable heresy, but it's the whole thing. OK, all of these are really five parts of marrying in the Lord. And marrying in the Lord means that you're not unequally yoked with somebody who's not a Christian. That's what I think is going on. I think it could have been written better, but I have no reason to think anything other than that. So it's really important. And kids these days and Christians these days don't take this seriously enough. Had a second cousin who got married last month. I wasn't able to go to the wedding. He was the ring bearer in my wedding. So he was like two. Cutest little guy, man. I don't know if he's a Christian, but I think he would probably say he is. Well, some of my relatives who were there were mortified at this wedding because it was not a Christian pastor. It was like this crazy woman universalist who starts praying to the earth. Marcia could correct me because I think she was there. But my aunt and uncle were absolutely mortified, his grandparents. He married. He broke this. No doubt about it. Now, whether or not he's a Christian, if he's not a Christian and he doesn't profess to be one, then, okay, the confession actually allows for him to do that. But I know his parents are. I know his grandparents are. I think he would say he's a Christian. This is what you call, this is what happens when the church does not teach things that you think are self-evident. They're not self-evident to people. Especially when they just want to get married. Right. That's all that matters. Are you compatible? You're compatible if you're in the Lord. I was last night, for whatever reason, I looked up what's the longest marriages ever. There's one couple that made it 90 years.
Isn't that the old elderly couple in Indonesia?
I think so, yep. Yeah. There's another couple that made it 86 years in this country. And I looked up, you know, they were asking, what was your advice or whatever? And they're like, divorce was never an option. Like, it was never an option. Like, that's the number one thing I tell people in marriage counseling. If divorce is never an option for you, then you'll never get divorced. No matter what happens. Now, you better forget each other while you're married or it's going to be pretty bad. But, yeah, you're compatible if you're a Christian. That's just the way it is.
Again, professing Christians, but not at all Christian. Like, don't go to church. They're Christians. would give a larger inheritance to the one who would be a better steward, kind of natural principle. But it's weird watching the world, and I'm like, why is it that the wicked seem to inherit so much? It's weird to me. Like, even if all my kids were terrible, I'll just be like, I'll leave it to the church, and I don't care. Like, if they're all evil pagans, and they go away from the Lord, like, that's fine, but I'm not giving you my money when I'm dead.
Well, I think that last thing you said is an application of saying they must be godly. They must not be wicked. So it's not enough to just profess to be a Christian. Like, you actually have to show signs of it. So don't go marrying somebody, oh, I'm a Christian. And then they never, ever show signs. They never want to go to church. They don't care about God. They don't want to pray. They don't never talk about him. Like, that's not a good sign. Yeah.
Yes, whether your affections seem to sway towards some other particular idol or something like that.
Or a guy or a girl.
Christian, but, you know, I sure like learning more about Buddha all the time.
Right. Right.
What about who gets married where one of them is divorced or both of them are divorced? If they claim Christianity, they get married for the second time. And I think you've talked in the past about statistics of divorce amongst non-believers and so-called Christians.
Same. The numbers are the same. Yep. They are the same. So I believe that our confession here, we'll talk about this in a later chapter, allows for divorce in the first paragraph, because you can't have more than one husband at the same time. So you can see that that's forbidding polygamy and polyandry. Now, there's more than one way that you could have a spouse that was a spouse, no longer a spouse. They could die. They could divorce.
The unbelieving spouse leaves.
The unbelieving spouse leaves. So abandon is another way. Now, just to say that, some people get really upset by that. We had a big church split. Only church split we've ever had was over this issue many, 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 many years ago. Because there was a whole group of people that could not take that you could ever allow for divorce, ever, under any circumstances, no matter what. If you do, it's literally the unforgivable sin. So they left the church. And they were teaching other people about this, and it was not good. Just because you say that divorce is permissible under some circumstances, it does not mean that what you are doing is giving carte blanche to evangelicals to divorce for any and every reason and have the same divorce rate as the world. That's absurd. Nobody would ever say that.
Then there was the instance where an individual who married a woman when he was supposedly unsaved, and then when he got saved, he wanted a divorce from her because originally, remember that situation?
Yep. I mean, it's all kind. There are many kinds of reasons for legitimate divorce, but the facts of the matter are in our culture is that the number one reason for divorce, and it's not even close.
Is you don't have the warm fuzzies anymore.
Yeah, that's right. I don't love you anymore. It's what irreconcilable differences. Sorry, that's not a biblical reason for divorce, and that's 95% of divorces out there. That's a great question. I mean, what's the? It's a great question, Stoss. What's the purpose of a prenup?
In the event of a contingency.
Yeah.
But is it sinful to predict that?
I suppose you could come up with some kind of reason that you could justify having a prenup. I certainly don't have one. I'm not a billionaire who married and is afraid my wife's going to steal half my money because she's only marrying me for my money. I was delivering pizzas when I got married, so. So I would say that a prenup would be something that I would have to put in a category of a weaker brother sort of a thing. I would say the stronger position would be, don't get a prenup. In the world, what are you doing? Yep.
God, in a sense, give us prenuptials.
Us?
Yeah. When he, what's coming to my mind?
Well, he might have given Israel a prenup.
Well, Christ said if you marry, and people take this different way, grace in the Lord, but if you marry a woman who says she's a virgin, she's not. That's immorality. If you marry and one commits adultery, which is the way other believers look at it, that's freedom. If your wife abandons you or your husband,
I see what you're saying.
The believer is not in bondage. And so
a
true believer face to face with a true believer will, I believe, in part to answer Scott's thought, will say that's our freedom.
I see what you're saying. So my answer would be this, that the same answer Jesus gave to the Pharisees. God, Moses allowed for divorce because you guys are evil.
That's right.
And so the prenups that you're talking about in Deuteronomy and stuff, those are given because we're evil.
Does that include, too, if someone takes your tunic, you give them your cloak?
Well, that's not marriage, but it's the same kind of an idea, I suppose.
But
the ideal, because my mind, when you first brought that up, Rick, my mind went to God himself. He's not giving me a prenup with him. Because I'm, as his bride, what's the whole point? He will never do me wrong.
Amen.
And so he would never give me a prenup as a Christian. And so if that's the ideal, I would think that that would be the way that you would want to carry it over into your marriage. Like, prenups to me seem to be founded on the idea that I don't trust you.
Pre-assumption,
yeah. Yeah.
I assume that you're going to try and steal
some or my small pepperoni pizza.
And Doug, I bring this up because with my own marriage, my goal isn't to make it married till death. My goal is to have heaven on earth and excel in being able to forgive Ceci as she forgives me in a real way that doesn't bring in bitter, galled resentment that I ever got married type thing. And everyone knows that's real. And so our warfare, my wife and I's warfare with the world and our own sin is to excel in love, meekness, gentleness, forgiveness, sweetness, you know, doting over her like I did when we were dating. That's our mark that I'm going after. And so if we're staying on that course, we're salmon swimming uphill because there's plenty of things to offend us. You know, I just found out I'm like Job. You know, it says in Job 19:70, my breath offends my wife. And if you heard that, it is right there. And by gracious forgive, and so you know these other things come in. Honey, we're not done that. We're staying up till 2 o'clock and settle this. Forgive me. It takes 4 out of 5. It takes work. You know, it takes work. And the rewards of it is a sweet spirit. And I'm chasing if we lose that. That's just where we're at. I'm just saying, you know, it's bigger than just law.
I had a friend that, my dad's, really my dad's friend. I'm friends with his kids, but you can tell the story because you would know better. I'm talking about Larry. He was married for a long time to a wonderful woman, and she got really sick. And eventually she died from it. He was worth a lot of money, and he got remarried. And what happened with that remarriage?
Well, I don't really know the whole story, but she was one that quite obviously married him for his money.
Mm-hmm.
And she made no bones about it, I guess.
Mm.
And she eventually, I think she was the one that left him.
Mm-hmm.
And in the divorce settlement, he got half his money.
Yep. So here's a guy, and I just thought about this because of your question, Stoss. Like, he had a great marriage for 35, 40 years, however long they were married. There was nothing wrong with it. And so he went into a new marriage completely eyes shut. And he lost half his money because this woman was just a gold digger. Then I thought, as you were talking there at the end, the verse struck me what Paul's talking about, business dealings. Why not rather be wronged? Just in light of the whole idea of prenup. And I thought, Larry specifically, I don't know what he would think about that or not, but just interesting to think about. If you're worth that much money and you lose half of it, to have Paul say, why not rather be wrong? You're a Christian. Instead of going the direction of a prenup, which I don't think he had.
I look at that situation that basically, I don't think he knew how to respond to that. And so he basically abandoned his friendships with almost everybody.
Yeah, all his friends, for lifetime friends.
I think he was so embarrassed that he didn't see this coming and enter into a proper marriage with a properly godly woman. And so that affected his life in ways that we will never know.
But that gets at, you know, some of the other stuff that we've been talking about. So your question about prenup is a really interesting one because it revolves around a whole lot of the stuff that's in this chapter. Debbie?
I would ask that question.
So that is what I wanted to say, is that I work for Christian attorneys, and there are some, that would have recommended a prenup. And between two true believers, that wouldn't have been an issue.
Mm-hmm.
That happens when one or two are left on, and then those children are not believers and don't behave properly, and it just saves a lot of mess.
Mm-hmm.
And if I should remarry and I have no plans to, I would do it again.
Interesting.
So do people change, I guess, is my question, because if the answer to that is yes, which if you have no answer, then I'm curious to get that as well. But the answer is yes, and you could also bank on total depravity also a little bit, it's not always for the better.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
It might be a matter of examining the human condition.
It might be, yeah. That's why I said that Strauss's question, I'm not going to say the Bible one way or the other is going to tell you what to do. You should use wisdom. And you should consider all the implications of doing that or not doing it. And then make your decision. Well, it's not just that you think. You did marry someone who was like that. They changed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying she wants to divorce me. She's made it very clear she doesn't. But she's also said, I would not marry.
I mean, you're going down a slippery slope. This gets into our next chapter with the Pope as the Antichrist. And what would a Protestant say about marrying a Catholic? Are they Christians? Like, that's a question we can raise if we want to. But, you know, I have a cousin. Or not a cousin. I have a niece who married, I actually went up to Canada to marry these two. He was a youth pastor. Great dude, one of the favorite people we've ever known. A couple years into their marriage, he decides he's an atheist. And guess what he's done to my niece? He's taken her right down that road. She's not a Christian anymore. So, life, this is Solomon in Ecclesiastes, is what this is. Life is messy. But I think that as far as principles go, if you take seriously what marriage is for, who you are to marry as a Christian, and you're using wisdom, that go a long way to at least mitigating some of this stuff. And if you don't, conversely, you're just begging for trouble. You might not get it, but you're begging for it.
Those who don't marry.
Yeah.
For many reasons. Providentially, it doesn't come up. Or, you know, they're deciding on it or something else. You know, whatever you want to put in there. But, you know, I keep thinking of it as there's, you know, scripture is talking about, you know, it's best not to marry due to circumstances or something like that, too. And it's like everything looks like a complete minefield of crap. That's not for everybody. You know, some people do, you know.
Well, here's an interesting question. What does this chapter say about singleness? Does it say anything?
Puritans say that it is a horrible poverty.
Well,
the greatest poverty.
What does this... I don't think they would always say that, no. They wouldn't say that, or otherwise they're denying what Paul said. They wouldn't say that. What does our confession imply about singleness? Well, I don't know that it says that either. But it certainly allows for it. It does not say, we do not confess that every single person has to get married. Right? And so therefore, because it's giving you what marriage should be and whatever, that's just simply laying down a definition of what marriage is and how you should enter into it. It doesn't tell you that you have to get married. Let's go to the last one. I thought we'd move way into the church on the next chapter, but you guys are like, you're all over this one, so.
I shouldn't have said what I said, because I'm trying to come to this church, so. I'm trying to
I meant what I said, because love is painful. And my wife was in the hospital such as could kill her. And that would rip every half of me out.
Right.
And because we strived in 35 years to put relationship above things. And I just want to say this. The degrees of your heart, the condition is in, will be pertinent to a marriage, isn't it? Some of you are older than me, you know this. And when you really realize that what we've been told, relationship with Christ and one another is the only thing that will last, that is true. I could have a house out here with millions, and without my wife, it's an empty shell. She makes the home, and I dread what's happened to us, that we have to die. Adam and Eve, this is how I've been thinking lately. Adam and Eve were not meant to be separated ever, and they died. And we're going to die, and that's going to rip our hearts out, depending on how soft they are to each other. Now, if we're Christians, we're good at our mate or our kids. Good riddance. I thank God that's not where we're at. You know, I know it's funny, but if we've made any progress in sweet holiness, and I realize God's heart was ripped out when his son was put to death. And his son was ripped up, and they never had a son. That's what I got to learn is what God did for me. Go back to the cross. I want you to see how much I lost my son for you. It tore my heart to see. That's all I can learn from my wife being sick is that's my bride. Yes, I know, Rick. You should see what happened to my son. It's all coming. I feel like I've known nothing for 35 years. I'm just learning the depth of love.
Well, let's just remember one more thing with this, that if you're single or if you're married, but if you're a Christian, in either case, you're already married. And you're married to Christ. And to his church. Not just you and Christ. It's you and the church. And so we already have, all of us have this relationship on one level, that spiritual level. And, you know, and things go bad with our spouse and we lose them, or we never get one, or whatever the case might be. Fall back on that truth, and it should be able to give you some comfort.
Amen.
Let's go to this last paragraph. Now, what do you get when you get 32 people from Arkansas in the same room? A full set of teeth. Now, why is that? It's because of this paragraph. Somebody listens to this one on the internet. Marriage ought not to be within degrees of consanguinity or affinity, forbidden in the word, nor can such incestuous marriages ever be made lawful by any law of man or consent of parties, so as those persons may live together as man and wife. So, three parts. You must not marry with close blood relations. And that's what the jokes of Arkansas and all that stuff is about, right? The church must not marry close blood relations. So you must not do it. The church must not do it. And any government that adopts laws to allow you to do it, it's not valid. Isn't that interesting that they put it that way? I think that has implications for other things that we've talked about this morning. That if a government says that two gay men are married, that doesn't make them married. Read it again. Marriage ought not be within degrees of consanguinity or affinity, forbidden in the word, nor can such incestuous marriages ever be made lawful by any law of man or consent of parties, so as those persons may live together as man and wife. How does that not directly apply to some of these other crazy things that are going on today? I think it directly applies to it. And you can call yourself married all you want. It doesn't make it so. Words have meaning, and you can't change what is.
I think it's going to have to be by trying to redefine marriage.
Exactly. Exactly. That's right. It's this whole game that we've been in for the last however many years is all, it's a word game. It's all it is.
It just creates more delusion, too, because, yeah, you know, these meetings are objective and transcendent.
They're trying to change reality. Can't do it.
Scooping poop over onto the truth of this whole thing, and the truth is still there, even if they manage to conceal it and they're hiding their wickedness on that.
Now, I had because you can't redefine it. You cannot redefine it. It is what it is. God defined it. It is what it is. You have a question? Okay. No, it hasn't.
Both Christians, we believe, that because they couldn't live without their former spouse's money, they agreed to marry, but not in the church or not with a government marriage license.
Did they have a pastor marry them? Or did they just say vows to themselves?
Well, at least one of them had somebody.
Well, yes, yeah, yeah.
Would this be addressing that in any way? Because government now is so involved in marriage.
Is this addressing? That's a good question.
I think if they would mail a check for the license to the government, they're all about money.
Well, the bigger question is, government does not, it is saying this, government does not legitimize or delegitimize something. if it's something that God has ordained, then God has ordained it. You know, how many of you have seen Braveheart? Kind of the classic example, right?
Oh, yeah.
Where William Wallace wants to marry his, you know, longtime girl, and so they go behind a rock, and he has a priest marry them. There's no government involved there. There's only three people there. But between them and God, and there was a pastor that married them. So they're married. Now, if it's two people that just say, let's just say our vows together, I don't think that that's not marriage. Even in Genesis, with Adam and Eve, guess what? They didn't marry each other. The angel of the Lord married them. He was there performing the ceremony. You're like, really? No, where does it say that?
The ceremony, he was also a witness.
Yeah, Scott. Or Lisa.
No, I joke, you probably don't want to hear that, but I would think that they would still be yoked to that ex-spouse by monetarily and not severing that relationship, the financial relationship. To me, that would be polygamy still, in a sense. They're not severing it. The finance part of it, she said that they don't want to fully acknowledge the release of that spouse because of the financial.
It's an interesting point.
The spouse is dead. I mean, that is kind of an interesting thing. So we're dealing with the government money shenanigans, which, shall I say, may God rend asunder.
It's a sticky one. Your question was basically, does this talk to that? And I would say only very indirectly would be my answer to that. Yeah.
Well, there's a question of depth of meaning as to what marriage is. And in this particular case that Joyce is talking about, both of the women lost their husbands to death.
Yeah.
I didn't hear that part.
Oh,
Yeah. Okay.
So the reason for them not being public with their marriage is because the government, which had no hand in their marriage, could end the benefits that they were legally entitled to if they declared their marriage.
I get it now.
Yeah.
So it's a somewhat different situation. Yeah. And you have to look at it with a different set of eyes. Than
I thought it was more than alimony.
Yeah, that's helpful.
But sometimes it can push, like I know a guy that was a doctor, he married a lawyer, she quit her job when they were going to get divorced. She got a new boyfriend and they had a service. She wasn't going to lose all this money she was getting until her kids grew up. She had no, her motivation was the coin. So it quickly, you know, people can say stuff, but if you're not following the laws of your land, you can do a lot of manipulation with it. And then there you are, you know, it's a, you could say it's between two Christians making a decision, but how do you know it's not leaning over to her motivation was money? She never married him that I ever heard, just so she could make sure that she got every drop of money she could out of the doctor.
He was still alive, right?
He was still alive, yeah.
Okay, so that's
right? Yeah, Debbie?
Married to someone else.
We're supposed to avoid any appearance of evil.
Mm-hmm. Here's the summary of this paragraph from the great sage of sages, Weird Al Yankovic. I was feeling pretty down till my girlfriend came around. We're just so alike in every way, I gotta say. In fact, I thought I might pop the question there that night. I was kissing her so tenderly, but woe is me, who would have guessed her family crest? I suddenly spied tattooed on her thigh, and son of a gun, it's just like the one on me. How was I supposed to know we were both related? Don't do that, all right? Come on now. The end.